All right, today's show is brought to you by the Canyon in West Yellowstone, which resides just a few hundred feet from the National Park's entrance. While they're open year-round, the shoulder seasons, April, May, September, October, and even November, are the perfect time to visit. My buddy Lucas was up there the other day, got some really nice brown trout swinging. The Madison inside the park, it's now opened year-round, which means you can fish streamers at dawn, then be back in time for a hearty hot breakfast with the family. One of the best parts about the shoulder seasons is to be able to explore the park while the crowds are light and animals are active. Streamer bite tends to be a little more consistent during these months as well. West Yellowstone truly is just such a good jumping off point for Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana. I mean, there's so much incredible fishing within 2 hours of West. Book your trip at www.yellowstonekellyinn.com. Use promo code SLIDE2025 for 15% off your stay. The Kelly Inn, family-friendly comfort, world-class fishing, all in one spot. Once again, use code SLIDE2025 for 15% off your stay. Thanks to our partners over at the Yellowstone Kelly Inn. All right, enjoy the episode. All right. Welcome back to episode 51 of the Sliding Podcast. I'm Brayden Anderson. That's Kelly Gallup.
Welcome back.
We'll probably have a really fun and interesting show for you today.
The last one was fun.
Yeah.
I think we beat it up. We're not going to do it this time.
Fidel Castro was not on my bingo card for words that would come out of my mouth in a fly fishing podcast.
What was that about?
I got a weird memory in mind.
Yeah, you got a weird everything.
I got my own problem, so leave me alone.
Sorry, Sydney.
All right, this question comes from Rich Hanusek. He says, "Hey, fellas, it's always special to listen to the pod. Listening last week with my son out in Montana on the way to the Blackfoot. Said fishing was spectacular, killer father-son outing. We ran out of all of sex dungeons. They were gobbling them. I've never experienced a bite like that. The fish would not touch any other color. We couldn't find one in any fly shop in Missoula after getting off the river. That will never happen to me again. It's special for us to float. We get out about every four times... Or we get out about four times a year on my visits from Minnesota. I always give my son the front seat when we float. I'm right-handed. When we are drifting down river left, I found myself always throwing backhanded due to wind and not wanting to give our guide friend an articulated headache from throwing a right-handed cast over the top of him. I also missed a few nice takes.
They deserve it.
Setting downstream. It still haunts me. I want to get better in this area, I have to admit. I had to throw a few over the guide's head to hit some great-looking banks. I will always learn strategies from watching all of you, but rarely see how to cast big streamers from the back of the boat. Can you give me advice on how to practice the skill? I want to show our guide that I grew in this area for next spring. You guys did a great job of capturing the essence of the mountains and lifestyle. You either get it or you don't. Montana's magical. What are Chuck's and Braden's short-term bucket list rivers to be fished yet? Chuck, I'm hoping... the newfound awareness and savings of electricity bills with your coworkers that Kelly will put up a few motion detectors. So after a long day at the shop, when you're enjoying a Rainier and a Brat, Angry Yogi doesn't violate your comfort zones. Thanks for taking the time, Rich." So there's a couple questions there. The one I want to focus on is boat casting, which... I don't know, you want to give your spiel on this? I think I obviously have the same one you do.
You know, back of the boat just sucks. That's just a part of the game, you know, and every guide's different. I didn't mind if I knew the client was able. I didn't mind them going over my boat, but that's only a rare number of humans, right? In other words, you're going down the river. For those who don't know, river left and right is indicative of the flow of the river. So
if you're facing downstream.
Downstream is the flow of the river.
Yes.
So it's left is the left side of the river, always by current. You don't get to turn. If you say lookers, that means you're looking upstream, yeah. Right? But river left, river right. The person in the back of the boat theoretically should not go to river left because you're going to cross the guide. And if it's a hindrance. Most guides say you're taking turns, the guy in the back of the boat, you just get shorted. Some people, you know, you got a lot of people now that are backhand casting, and so they'll cast and go, you know, I think it's a better stated. There's not really a way to change the fact that your line is going to go. If you're going to the left bank in the back of the boat, you are coming over, unless you're a left-hander, obviously, you're coming over your right shoulder. And if you drag a tailing loop, you know, or not drag one, but just drag a loop and it comes up and it tails, it's coming at the guide, not at you. And that's bad mojo. So for the most part, but there is this thing Johnny was telling me about how people are coming back on a backhand and doing it. They don't really hit it well. And he said, he told me, you know, I just tell him, I watched him cast a minute, says, just try to go over your head. Just do it, right? Just don't, he says, I don't think you can hurt me with this fly anyway. You know, he puts his glasses on and goes, it's a hard one. Most guides would say, just no. And you should be good with that if the guide says it, because you're not the one going to get hooked. If the guide says, you know, no river left if you're a righty, you just fish the middle of the river and start reading and identifying that there's more than just a bank, right? There's a lot of mid-river shit that nobody ever fishes. You know, your really big fish tend to head in those big river, mid-river things. The Blackfoot's a great, got a lot of good mid-river stuff on it. Matter of fact, I'd say it's got just as much good mid-river as it's got bank fishing. Maybe more in some sections, but I would just say this is 100% on your guide.
Yeah,
because guides have rules for reasons. You don't want to wear a sex dungeon. If you were throwing a dry fly, what could it hurt, right? You've always got your sunglasses on. You're not going to get it in the eye. But you throw a sex dungeon, you can mess somebody up pretty good. Put it in their ear, and but I don't know. It's just that's what I would do.
So I struggle with this one. I'm a big believer in like not casting off your upwind shoulder, and so I remember yelling at my dad in the boat one day because we were out throwing hoppers down by town, and he's trying to throw. The wind is coming upstream, right? And he's in the front of the boat. Because he's fat. My mom's in the back of the boat.
Your dad?
He's not. Yeah.
He's your size.
He's 6 foot tall. He's got about 40 pounds on me. He's not fat.
You said he was fat.
Yeah, I joked that he's fat. That was a joke. Yeah.
I was going to say, he's not fat at all.
He's not fat at all. He's in very good shape, but he's a couple inches taller than me and heavier. But he's much heavier than my mother, who's in the back of the boat, right? Because we didn't want to be doing a wheelie into a headwind. And, so he's trying to throw backhand river right with the wind coming at him. And I'm like, you got to throw over my head. And he says, I don't want to hook you. And I'm saying, you have a much higher chance of hooking me throwing backhand sidearm in front of you than you do if you just go over my head. It's like, I prefer people to throw. And this is with the advent of wind, right? Mm-hmm. If there's wind involved, go over my head every time. And now I'm not a fishing guide. I would say when I am in a boat with people, they're generally much better anglers than the average client.
Right? Everybody you fish with is
really good.
Really good.
I fish with guys who are really good, who fish a lot, who are really good casters. So it doesn't bother me to have them go over my head.
No. Now,
it's annoying when you're sitting in that rower seat and somebody's picking up that streamer and you're getting, you know,
every cast
splashed every single time.
Right in the eardrum.
Always. Or somehow.
Behind your glasses.
I don't know how it gets
behind
glasses.
Behind your glasses.
I don't know.
Every time.
I was talking with Nate about that the other day. He's like, it's like a heat-seeking missile to your pupil.
You don't get three casts without taking that water shot.
No. So when there's wind involved, and the other thing is like, a lot of people are really, they're really good traditional casters, like forehand casting. Mm-hmm. As soon as you try to bring the backhand thing in, shit hits the fan.
That's what Johnny and I were talking about. I don't dig it. I mean, I've seen guys, you know, that are really good at it.
Like Nathan's really
Nate's
good at it.
Nate's really good at a backhand. That's what he does.
And what
he fishes more backhand.
I do, if I'm like front of the boat going to river left, I'm more sidearm, right? Kind of out away from me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm, you know, switch around to go river right, a lot of the time my rod's almost vertical and I'm over myself, right?
Yeah.
So I don't to backhand.
That's my point, is that if you... You shouldn't, well, first and foremost, if you're throwing a dungeon, you're on a sinking line, and if you're on a sinking line, you should never false cast that. It should be one back, and you should deliver your fly. You, Never false cast those things. Just one and done. And you should be able to keep it high. But if your guide says nothing over the boat, it's nothing over the boat.
It's their boat.
It is their boat. They are the captain.
Yeah.
And so, and I, you know, I'm not, I've seen very few people that can backhand the way Nate can, or it's just, and I don't think it's that big of an advantage either,
no.
You know, but to go, if you want to go river left out the back of the boat and stand sideways all day and throw backwards, that's, at least you're not going over your guide. It's good. I mean, if you're good at it, that solves all problems.
Right.
But for the most part, start with the, ask the guide and make sure, and you should be able to pick a fly up and drop it, and it should go straight up over your head. You should be able to do that. It's a steeple cast.
Yeah, exactly.
And just go and until you get to the front of the boat, then you can enjoy your life. Or tell your kid to get his own boat. I'll be in the front all day with my own guide.
Yeah.
Or make your kid do it.
So you said earlier that the back of the boat is just a bummer. I know.
Only on river left, if you're right-handed.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think...
And there's other things. There's other obstacles too. You got the oars and stuff like that.
Yeah, you got oars you're dealing with.
Yeah, yeah. And where do you retrieve? Do you do? It's always, but that's just part of life. It's not always.
Richard Tuzzi was saying that he actually prefers the back of the boat. It keeps him locked in, and he just hits every spot. The guy in the front doesn't.
Yeah.
He thinks he catches more fish. I think he was just trying to be an asshole to me that day and disagree with me.
I don't.
You think the back of the boat's better than the front of the boat?
Not necessarily, but I do exactly what he said. If you're a good, you should be peripherally looking down that river every second. You should be looking at the first in the front, where their fly hit, making sure they hit where it should have, coming in behind it. You know, you get the opportunity to see where it hit, and you can time your cast to go 4 or 5 feet below it.
My argument there is if you're that cerebral and you're doing that in the back of the boat, well, in the front of the boat, you have your first choice of everywhere you want to throw.
Well, obviously, he'd be in the front. He's being...
That's what I mean. He's being an asshole.
No, he was being polite. So that's a problem with you fucking liberals. What are you kidding me? He's being very nice. He's saying, giving you the opportunity to be in the front of the boat.
No, I've never fished with him. He was saying that he was out with a friend and that he kicked his ass from the back of the boat.
Well, maybe that was nasty. He just wanted to kick his buddy's ass.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. And then he goes, actually, I do.
I just don't see Rich doing that.
He said he thinks it's better to be in the back of the boat and you catch more fish from the back. That's the first person I've heard say that. I think.
I had Jerry Dennis do it to me once and Jerry Wilson do it to me once.
I mean, it totally happens. Kyler kicked my ass the first time we fished together. He kicked my ass from the back of the boat.
He was
a cocky little shit about it, too.
Yeah, it's really good, too. Yes, there. Onward.
All right.
I think we answered that.
Next question.
Can't believe nobody in Missoula didn't have a dungeon.
Yeah.
Bicycle seats.
Bicycle seats. I do think they like colored hair and sitting on bicycle seats in Missoula. Sorry if you live there. It's not that bad. I like to drive through a lot.
There, I'll give you one I've got here that I said I was going to do 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, you do that.
Want to do it?
Yeah.
Good. We'll do this one. This is I get a lot of, I don't respond to all my letters. I feel like a piece of shit for not doing it, but I get a lot of them. I take them home and I read them. And this one I took home and I read, and I was going to respond to it a while back and didn't. This is from Hale Rickles. And he says he's an elementary teacher, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I'm just kind of going through it. Avid fly fisherman in the Driftless, upper Midwest. I'm sure you may be curious as to why I'm writing you a letter in this day and age. I feel it's just the most sincere form of communication humans have. I think that's a great line.
Yeah,
I was having a problem time with one of my daughters, Delaney, and I sent her a text, and it was probably I should have called her. She's the greatest for calling you out on the carpet. And she said, I said, well, I text you. She says, texting is the lowest form of communication since the smoke signal.
That's really good.
She's like 13 years old.
Wow.
She's always had that ability to just go, ha, how do you like this?
Yeah, anyway. She sounds like
so
you.
It's a she's great. Anyway, it says, where is the communication? I guess, I'm interested in learning a few things about you simply about asking questions about fly fishing and tricks. I've always enjoyed learning someone's story, so I hope you'd, I would love to know how and when you got into the sport and what keeps you coming back to the fly tying bench in the river day after day. And I think I've answered that kind of in different places here and there. I got my start in this business. Well, I don't know how you get your real start. I mean, you start tying and stuff and selling flies at a tackle shop. But in reality, I got it started guiding. And then but in the real world, you know, of today, when you're starting writing for Fly Fisherman in 80 something, I don't remember, 83 maybe, something like that, in my first article. And that was kind of, that got me going, and that just, and then just a lot of things kept going from there, who you guide, and then hooking up with Gene Herring at Flyfish TV. I had a TV show on, or just a weekly thing on the news in Traverse City too. But that got me going, and then it just keeps going. You know, we move out here, everything just keeps building on itself, writing, doing TV and all that crap. But the tying bench and the other thing, it's funny because I was going to answer that a month ago, and I set it on the counter and just kept walking past it and forgot it. And then last night when I was sitting, I've got this cold thing going on. I've been sitting in the house. And that bench thing, that's really interesting to me because I've had a few. I love taxidermy, right? And I walked out of my taxidermy shop 3 years ago and didn't even walk in. I cleaned it up a month ago and mounted a fish. And I'm like, wow, that was a blast. It's one of my favorite things in the world.
Yeah,
I walked out and quit. I don't know why. Wasn't mad at anything. I just walked out and said, I just don't want to do this anymore. And I have no idea why. And the same thing happens to me in the fly tying. I can I'll go through these spells, not in the old days, because everything was, in the old days, what brought you back to the vice is we were innovating so much. We were designing flies and we were making new flies and making them swim differently and replacing hooks and rebuilding material, you know, bringing new materials were coming out and all these different things that kept you going. But I had the same thing happen to fly tying about 2 years ago, where it was like, I don't know. There's just something was not really, you know, there was nothing to, it wasn't designing anything.
Yeah.
And part of that came from not guiding as much and not fishing as much. You know, business gets going and you got this and that and you got those girlfriends that take up all your time, except Mel, who's the best. Just kidding.
Just kidding, baby.
But what keeps me going is the design end of it, where I think about things. But one of the things that triggers that, as crazy as it seems, because I was doing it just 2 days ago, I'm going through my old books and I look at flies. And one of the things about fly fishing is that they're just beautiful. They're just really cool, right? And I was looking through second edition of Trout, I've talked about Trout 1,000 times. Joe Brooks, the cover's gone off of this one, but this original Trout, this is second edition. And I go through these old books, and in particular, there's one fly that's done it to me all my life. And it's a polar chub. And it's this fly right here.
You just tied one of those, didn't you?
No, I've never tied one.
Oh, you had something behind the desk that looks similar.
Similar, but I've never tied a polar chub to this. And I see it, and there's a bunch of flies like that. A good 9-3, a polar chub, a Thunder Creek, which in this one they call it Flusher's Silver Minnow, which then it ended up being the Thunder Creek. Remember, I think the guy was from Wisconsin that did it first. But there's these certain flies that just trigger me. And I look at them and I get like this, I never see them purdy like this. I see them in the water. And I've never done one that well. And every time I see it, I go, okay, now how can a Carrie Stevens Rapid River or a Gray Ghost. Oh my God, I can just stare at the fly and my brain goes all over the place. Mm-hmm. Some of these flies are 80 years old, right?
Yeah.
And Joe Brooks's book, I was talking, like, there's the original blonde right here, right? That's the original blonde.
Yeah.
And that, but I go through I'm looking at these books and I'll see these pictures And I'm just kind of mesmerized knowing the fact that they had probably a tenth of the materials we had when these flies were designed.
If that, yeah. Maybe?
If that.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, they were catching fish on them, and I caught fish on them. I never tied a polar chub like that. I tried to. They're out of polar bear. That's part of it. I didn't have all the dye colors. Polar bear is so beautiful. But, you know, it's either completely like, I've talked about this thing lately a lot, this bodiless fly that has nothing to it, right? It's just a hook. The hook's down here, and then it's got its little head and its body. That gets me interested to go back to the vise and go, you know, excuse me, go back to the vise and go, well, what could I do different? But the thought, like, I know people that tie, a lot of Atlantic salmon guys that tie someone else's fly forever.
Yeah.
I can't do that.
No.
Excuse me.
I think we need to get you on the spey rod and then designing swing flies.
I did tons of swing flies back in the day, but I wasn't spey fishing, single hand.
Yeah.
But that gets me too, where I just like, I'll go on, but it's not, that's more beauty. That's more like just trying to make a
I'm curious perfect. What you'd come up with if you're trying to innovate, not just make something look pretty, but
right.
Like,
I've done a few like that, but mine were more partly because I lived in Michigan, but partly by what Harry Lemire said to me that one time about when I told him about the guy catching that giant on a popsicle.
Yeah.
And he said that was a lure, right? It bugged him for some reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says, I showed him I was fishing. He says, well, that looks like something in the river. So a lot of my spey flies looked like I did a lot for hex patterns because it was Michigan, mm-hmm. but they worked great in BC too.
Yeah.
They're just, an October caddis is an October caddis, right? Right. Who cares? If it's you might not have a hexagenia, but they're still food based. It's mm-hmm. still going to look like something. And so, but it just, something to just sit and tie. That's why I frequently tell people and they ask me, do you sit and tie all day? I says, no, I got like a six fly ass. And so it's like six flies, then I got to go see if they work. And then it becomes fun to take the variations of it, right? Make them bigger, smaller, different colors, and start blending all that stuff, and then you get it. But at that point, like other dungeons, I don't have to tie another dungeon. You know, I like mine weightless, so I'll tie my own if I want them with lead eyes. But other than that, I'll just take them off the shelf half the time.
Right.
You know, if I'm going someplace special, I might tie up a few, but. But to come back to this table every day, and including the river, going back to the river, we were talking last show about how Kurt had said he has to catch his fish with their heads up. He doesn't care about nymphing another fish up. He has to do. And so when I design a fly, I go out and see if it does. That keeps me going to the river, right? Go to the river, see if the fly, if this new fly will do what it's supposed to do, right? And then you give one to you, give one to Johnny, Nate, whoever, and you know, Chuck, go fish this fly.
Mm-hmm.
And is how does that work for them, right?
Right.
That keeps me coming back here and to the river. You know, I fish half of what I did even 10 years ago, just due to life. But I still get out, like in the evenings, you know, all through the summer, I still get a 45-minute hour, hour and a half maybe, mostly every night. But I cannot go with a fly that I know. That's part of my rules. I have to come up with a new fly.
Right.
Or do something like that new bubblehead thing. That gives me something to go test, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But nobody has to wonder if you take I don't have to wonder if I take a
parachute
found atoms. Leak parachute, yes. Atoms out, are they gonna, you know, a missing link.
Yeah.
Mike Mercer's fly, you don't have to wonder if they're going to eat the damn thing.
Right.
They're going to eat it every time.
Yeah.
Right, it's just a great fly. And so, but when you design one for a purpose, not just changing the color of something, but you design a new style and you go, oh cool, now I get to go out. But
right.
to tie or to just fish without that purpose, I wouldn't come back as much as I do. So that's your answer, Hal. And sorry it took me, like, thank God, you know, I realize you're a teacher and you have great penmanship and it was a very well-written letter, but you didn't put the date on thank you.
Yeah.
Because it could have been 3 years
Isn't
ago.
Isn't that like an immediate, I think I had some class where that was an immediate failure if you don't do the heading properly, you know, your name, the date, the teacher's name,
well, he did say
the subject.
I think he did say he's a PE teacher, so he's probably not doing a lot of written stuff in there, but I'm an elementary PE teacher from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Oh, he's close to the Driftless too. That is such great fishing over there. Don't tell anybody. Don't ruin yourself.
I'm going to refrain from talking about this because I made some enemies last time.
Good.
All right. I'm not even sure I want to say who this question's from because the guy has asked this question like 15 times. And he keeps emailing and DMing us. So I'm just going to read it. And he wants an answer. So we're going to give you an answer. He says, just listen to episode 67, which that's 20 in the future, so maybe he's clairvoyant. I'm once again...
I was 66. Was that good?
Yeah, well, 66, like. I am once again asking Kelly to explain why he bitches about the whole distance casting thing, causing rods to get stiffer and lines to get heavier when he uses a, quotes, 7-weight Streamer X with a 250-grain line. Side note, I'll do the side note after. So he's basically asking, why are you a hypocrite?
Because I can be. well, first of all, I don't bitch about distance casting. I just say I don't do it. I think it's irrelevant to fishing. You know, if you're distance casting, I will qualify this, and I will bet anybody that ever wants other than Howard Crossner or Bruce Richards or either the Ray Jeff brothers. But even then, I think I'd do it. At 65 feet, people tell me they can hit a Dixie Cup. I'll put $1,000 a cast. And I've offered it to a lot of people. I've watched a lot of people. 65 feet is a lot of line. Yeah. And you just don't fish 65 feet away from you very often.
I mean, the best guys up in West Yellowstone at that casting competition, there was an optional 50-foot hula hoop. That's a hula hoop, not a Dixie Cup. And a couple of guys got it twice. You could shoot at it twice. You lose points if you miss. So
that's a 3-foot circle.
Yeah. And I didn't shoot at it because I had a good score going into it. And I was, you know.
Yeah. 50 foot's a big cast. It truly is.
The top three guys all hit the 50 ring twice in a row.
Yeah. I'm not saying he couldn't do it, especially if he hit it.
That's a 3-foot ring.
Yeah. But you should be able to.
A 3-inch.
That's 50. 65 is a whole different world.
Well, 65.
That's what I hear. I hear it from the guys all the time. That if, you know, always the saltwater guys are bitching at me about if you can't do that. I've been in a lot of saltwater boats. I've seen very few people do it, or cast that far really. And I do it on the lake. I'll fish 65 feet. I generalize. I'm talking about what I do most of the time on the river.
Well, and you're trying to give advice to the average angler, right?
Be really accurate within 40 feet, and 40's a ridiculous cast too, from a fishing perspective. Especially if you were a dry fly guy. But if you're a nymph guy, it'd be impossible. I mean, how are you gonna? Well, I guess if you're a bobber fishing, you could get away with it maybe a little. You're still going to have a line on the water. It's going to be really hard to do. But I'm just talking reality. And again, your reality and mine might be completely different. Now, I'm assuming when we, and so I'm not really bitching about, Braden's a great distance caster. Bruce Richards, one of the best. Howard Crossen's arguably one of the top three ever. I mean, he's a world champion caster also. I've never seen Howard throw a 70-foot cast on the river. I've never seen him. I mean, he fishes his water.
He fishes from 35 feet.
Like yeah, and you fish your water. And it's why you're a world champion. And if there was ever going to be a study in it, it would be him or Bruce. And you go fish with Bruce, they're perfect casters. I mean, their delivery is perfect. Not sometimes, every time. Mm-hmm.
Howard folded one.
Yeah, bullshit. It was like the last cast of the day.
You know,
and folded to you and him. To you, he's folded this much, the fly was short of his thing, instead of being touching exactly.
Yeah, he made a noise.
Yes. Yeah, after 4 hours of
perfection. Yes.
But So I'm not really, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. But going to the hypocritical part of why do I run a 7-weight with a 200 grain line, I'm assuming now.
250.
Huh?
250.
Yep. Okay, well.
No, so he's saying why would you use a 7-weight for a 250? Like you mm-hmm. it's your rod, it's your line.
Correct.
Why first is that a 7-weight?
First and foremost, streamer rods, my streamer rods are not true 7-weights. They're 7-weights in the center, but they have a tip and a butt that it's not. It's an 8.
Yeah.
And so one, and they're for a function, which you would understand, you know, if you understand this. And I assume you're going off grainages, which you're talking about dry fly grainages, which, and the reason I say bitch about the lines, because if you're going to say, if a 6-weight's a 165, but you've got dry lines that are 190 now, they're still designated as a 6 because the rods are no longer flexing at what 165 grains would do to flex a traditional dry fly rod. Now they're coming back. We're watching this. We're going backwards.
Like the rod Kurt dropped off.
Yeah, you. It's pretty close to true to weight. It's still probably a little over.
Which is an R8 classic for this.
Yeah, but pretty damn close to how it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But when you start talking about streamer lines, one, your lines, you're going to be casting shorter probably, but because the line is truly not, and it's not a rod, I mean, it's not truly a 7-weight, it's 8 in the butt and 8 in the tip, 7 in the center to flex the rod to open it up a little bit so that you can cast a sinking line. Now physics come into play. So you've got a fly that's heavier than your dry fly. You're talking grainage, whoever you are, you're talking grainage that is probably 30-year-old technology thought process that the rod flexed of like a RP Sage, say, you know, the original Sages, which was a great, or an LL Sage, the original LLs. Right, these rods were flexing, so a 6-weight would flex at 165 grains, and it would flex everything fine. Now, if you took that same line and you put it on an 8-weight, it wouldn't bend the rod, right? Because you're fishing a dry fly. Now you're using the weight of the line only to flex the rod. So when you fish streamers, so on my rod, which is truly an 8-weight, I guess if you want to get down to it, other than the middle, the midsection. If you get down, now I've got a fly that is the equivalent of 45 parachute atoms hooked together.
Maybe more.
Maybe more, right? So the line has now to facilitate the cast, the fly has to be, the line has to drag the fly. Mm. So the grainage has to be sufficient to carry the fly, and the rod has to flex in a certain zone to carry the line. So you upline, but not really. If you go back in time and you look at a 250 grain, like a 250, Teeny's lines, the guy who really started all of this.
Yep.
We ran those, a 250 was run on a 7-weight, 9.5 foot was a common steelhead rod, right? A 9, maybe even an RPL back then. So you've got a rod that is a 7-weight RPL on a 250. My rod's really an 8-weight in the tip and the butt, because my rods are about the same as the, you know, more like an 8 in the hind end and a little bit less in the tip, and then the midsection's a true to weight. And so it flexes. The reason is that is because you're using a bigger fly and you do not want a tight loop with a sinking line. And you got to carry a bigger fly. If you were going, but you have to figure out, when you call me a hypocrite, you don't know anything about the rod.
He didn't, oh. he didn't do
Well,
that.
If you're not yeah. calling, if you're asking me why, it's not hypocritical. It's just the rods, all the lines have changed. There's a reason there are 4-5-weight designated lines, or 6. We'll go to 6-weight. So you've got a true, a 6, I think it's a 165. And so now you've got a 6, 6.5, 7, and 7.5. Yeah. All designated 6-weight.
Right.
That's not because That's because the rods are not true to weight as they were 25 years ago. I mean, it's just, all you got to do is pick one up. I mean, pick up an RP or an LL from, you know, the 90s and pick up any rod in the same weight today, and you're going to be like, whoa, that doesn't feel anything the same. Yeah. Or God help you if you go back, because those line designations didn't, as far as I know, didn't change since we came off the old style of designating the lines. When we designated, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right, all that, back, and I don't remember the, well, I do when I see them, I just can't remember the, it was a letter system with a number and then the letters. And as far as I know, it's never changed. So now you're really talking about Fenglass. You're talking about Fenwick, Berkeley, Shakespeare. You're talking, none of the other rods are around to speak of. You're talking about fiberglass. And then we come out graphite, and suddenly nothing changes. Well, the rods change significantly. Mm-hmm. Their flex zones change significantly. They're much stiffer, and we didn't go with it. That's why scientific anglers went, well, I think Rio was the first one to do it. They went half over on their fly line. And then, but then scientific anglers now has at literally four designated lines under the 6 weight or whatever line it is. So it's true to weight, half over, one over, one and a half over, two over. Well, tell me who's, so why is that? Why would you do that? Because the rods got faster. That's the only reason. And so that's why we do the 250 on a 7. And I don't always do 250s on 7s, actually. Yeah, usually. But not always. I'll drop it down. All my streamer floating lines are a 1 or 1.5 over. But I'll drop them down on a floater to be more true to weight. But I don't fish those big, heavy flies either when I do that.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I think, but that's the reason. And distance, again, is not, everybody likes to go through. I go out in the lake, of course you want to go throw farther. It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
If I'm fishing rising fish, I don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, close the gap.
I was having this debate with Nathan the other day because we went out and floated, and right off the bat, he's holding me 70 feet off, and I'm like, hey, can we get closer? He goes, what, you can't throw that far? Like, I can put it 60 feet past that. That's not the point. I want to control my fly. He goes, well, we're searching. This is like a new place we've never floated. I go,
Lake or river?
River. Hmm. But he's of the mindset of like cover as much water as possible.
Thanks for that.
I've spent too much time with you, whereas I'm of the mindset of like, well, why don't we start by fishing the first drop off the bank or the shallows, mm-hmm. right? Really hammer that, fish it well. And if we don't move them there, then we'll drop out to the trough. And if they're not there, then we'll fish the middle. Like, I like to feel like I covered a certain type of water really well and then try to find where our fish are.
Mm-hmm.
And he likes to do the opposite. And I'm not sure one's better than the other. I think there's multiple ways.
When we started, that's what we did. We threw as far as we could and we found out where the fish were going to come from.
Yeah. And it comes back to this.
We hoped.
It comes back to the hunting versus hoping. Mm-hmm. And what I kept saying is, look, I throw spay rods more than I throw single hand rods. I am, by definition, a hoper, right? Like, mm-hmm. I cover massive water, you know, hoping that these fish are in the certain places, trying to put my fly in front of as many different lies as possible. But when I have a single hand rod in my hand, I like to be at that, you know, 40 and in.
Me too.
And hunting.
Well, there's also from a drift boat perspective, you're covering water pretty quickly, no matter what you think.
That's what I
mean, you're on a 11, 12 second retrieve rotation, you're closing 35 to 60 feet, depending on your river.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to, you know, just to go. I mean, it's just physics. You can't stop how fast you're going.
Right.
I mean, and you get on this river and you think you're doing 1 mile an hour. Yeah, right. Good luck with that one. And so you cover water or on the South Fork. You get on the South Fork, the snake. It looks so placid in so many places. There's a lot of volume pushing your ass down that river. You are moving. And so
the best way to figure that out is look across the river from you and see, you know, something that you're going to try to get to.
Yeah.
And then you show up.
Yeah.
250 feet below it.
It's different than you think. So it's just, you know, I'm going to pick on the distance guys forever, mostly because I can't do it as well as they can. But there's the other thing is just, it's just physics. You know, things have got faster. The lines did not change with the rods.
Right.
And so now they've changed with the rods. And you want to see a, you want to see the definition of perplexed. Watch somebody walk in and look at the, there's, you know, Cortland, there's SA, there's Rio, and there's, who else is up there on that wall?
I think that's it now.
That's it on that wall. And you say, they say, I need a floating line for my five weight. And you say, well, here's your 11 choices.
Yeah.
How would you?
I mean, the SA alone has how many?
Well, four.
At least they put four, it on the. They put it on the
four
box
per box. Four per. But then you got textured and non-textured. Right. Yeah. So, and then you got the four, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, well, do we have 12 lines here? Do we have what do we have? And that's just one company.
Well, it's
and then the people will look at you and go, I mean, we always say, let's just start here. Give me your. Let me see your rod. And you shake the rod and you go, okay, you want this line. Okay. There's no, one out of 100 might walk in and say, I want this line.
Right.
One well, out of 100 nowadays. Like, because it's not like walking in, when I was a kid, you walk in and you got 444 peach and you got, you know, you got a scientific angler's mastery. That was it. And you got to choose between two.
I was instructed to do this when I started working here, and I, like I've said before, I came in pretty green, but I learned, you know, I'm still learning, but I learned a lot quickly from guys like Jeremy and Chris and Johnny and yourself.
Somebody learned something from Johnny?
One time.
That's good to know.
So if you call a fly shop or go into a fly shop and you say, I need a new line for my six weight, if that isn't immediately followed by which rod,
yeah,
a six weight, no, what exact six rod weight. If that isn't part of the conversation, you should probably walk out of that fly shop or you know, try to find someone who is really interested in getting you the right line, because every rod, like, I mean, 90s, 2000s, 2010s to now, mm-hmm. there's been so much variance in speed and stiffness of these rods that, like, everyone probably needs a different
rod. And by the way, back to this distance thing, that is why I bitch about it. Because when I started, my first fly shop, I started in 1979 out of my home on the Rapid River. And I've been continuously in it pretty much all my life. And so people did not used to walk out into the yard and rip off 70 feet of line and start doing the up and down rocking horse casting to see if they're, mostly because the rods wouldn't do it, yeah. right? Your rod, if you take a Fenglass, you know, if you take the early fiberglass or late fiberglass and the early IMG graphite, and you see people, we're still kind of used to casting, fishing casting. And then you watched it just go where everybody started doing the rocking horse, the stupid thing where they're out there and they're trying to throw 70 feet. And 95% of the anglers who do that roll a toiling loop on their second false cast and plop that shit down. And they'll get a good 60 footer out there with 10 more feet dragging behind it. So it was an absolutely worthless cast. Mm-hmm. And I watched that for, unlike most people, I've been watching it for about 45, 50 years. And so I saw this ridiculous thing come with the faster rods about, and then I'd be on the river and see people trying to do it. You want to watch, you watch one tailing loop on the second false cast hit the water and watch the wheels fall off a wagon when a guy's trying to go 45 feet when he really should be casting 10 or 20.
Okay.
And it's like, oh, and then you see this crazy shit and they're looking all over. And I watched it. Now, the people that were good, the Bruce Richards of the world, Bruce and I had dinner, and Susie and Mel and I had dinner the other night, and we were talking about the, his dad was a rep. Bruce is one of the best casters in the world, for sure top one or two instructors for advanced casters in the world. Mm-hmm. And I says, and then pretty, I says, nobody even remembers before Sage and before things. It was like when Berkeley was still a big, the cherry, that was a big thing.
Yeah.
And the Wonder Rod was still a big thing. You pick those things up now and you'd be like, woo, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
I mean, I took one, did that show up above. I took my 7.5 foot. Well, I should have had a 9'5" fast rod. It is, you get out of control, especially you're not used to running glass. When you get out of control, man, the wheels fall off so fast. But that is why I watched this transition, and I really think it made worst casters and worst anglers for about a decade. And I've brought it up before about the guy who had Fisher, Kenny Fisher. I can't remember his first name. But anyway, he had an ad that said, "My rods won't go the distance." Because he thought it was so stupid. I think it buried the company.
Yeah, probably.
But and it was just this thing, right? Whereas from a fishing perspective, I don't, you know, we were talking about this morning before we started filming, how often pro jocks, like I'll go fish with Bruce, or no one ever says, you know, nobody ever starts casting like, "Can you cast that far?" Nobody even talk. Pros don't talk like that. They go fish, and you don't see them throwing
like
these casts.
You said pros don't talk about what knots they tie.
Not knots. Not the cat. Yeah. Can you hit that? You don't do that. They go fish and they fish a little, and they stalk. I always bring up watching Renee Harrop fishing that one time. He was like a heron, man. He was like a ninja up there. He's just so stealthy and makes his one cast. It's like, yeah, that was cool. But I don't see, even when we all fish together, you just don't hear that. You don't see the trying to show off for the cast because they're all fishy.
Yeah.
I just don't, and I've fished with hundreds of guides, salt guides, musky guides, trout guides, bass guides. Nobody does it.
See,
nobody. They go fish, but yet when we get on these forums and we start talking, and I'll get 200 people writing, "You're so full of shit. I can cast 90 feet, $1,000 a cast." It'll stand up. I'll stand out here any day of the week with anybody. I'll give you a paper plate, and I'll give you your 75, and you won't even have to be in moving water. You won't even have to be in the deck of a boat that's moving with your guy pulling it to the side. So you won't have to lead your fish. You won't have to do anything. Howard told me that the reason he won that world championships in the world thing is they put a moving target on.
Yeah.
And nobody could hit the moving target. That's what all the salt guys tell me when they're bitching at me. They're not usually bitching. They're usually giving in good fun, usually.
Right.
Because they're pro jocks. I asked Billy Pate once at lunch, the last time he threw 75 feet to a tarpon. He said, "I don't think I ever have." Like, why'd you say it in your video? I don't know why we do it in videos, but
that'd be a fun video to film, to go out to the parking lot and set up a paper plate at 75 feet and just see.
Get all of
our best casters and see, you know, because
We've done it to see how often people, you get out there and people are watching you.
Yeah.
Of course, then the shit goes that.
Well, we always only try to throw for distance. We've never actually thrown in the accuracy at distance.
Right.
There's a bunch of guys here who can dump fly lines.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, depending on your line, 90 to 110
but
feet.
I always hear about guys that are in a boat. And if, every time I've been on the front of a boat, the fish is moving. Not always, but I don't have to throw 90 feet to a tailing bonefish that's coming at me. I mean, I got to lead it, right?
Yeah.
But if the tarpon's going one way or the other, the boat's getting moved and you're trying to lead the fish, and you're going to do with a 11 weight, you're going to false cast what? How many times and hit that? It's just
right.
Things start going awry in reality.
Things go bad. Yeah.
I'm not belittling distance casters. I hang out with some of the best in the world. I mean,
It's just fun to talk
Tim
shit about.
And Steve. Yeah. I'm not talking shit about it. I'm saying it shouldn't be the precedent that you're trying to, that shouldn't be why you buy a rod or a line so you can throw 70 feet. Because you, unless you're steelheading.
Yeah, unless you're trying to compete, right?
Like yeah, I mean, if you want to do that.
Yeah.
That's not the guy that's listening to this.
No. Or maybe. Gal. I don't know.
Yeah, but they're already past it. Right. That's the guy that when we person that we go fishing with that no one ever says, can you cast 70 feet? Can you hit that?
Well, Howard was telling us a story about one of these guys who's a big online caster. And like the guy can throw it. He's really good. He's one of the best out there.
There are so many great distance
spay
casters.
Rod, single hand. I mean, he does all sorts of really cool stuff. He's a really great caster. Well, Howard said one of his friends knows him or something, so I don't know if any of this, whatever, but he said that the guy went out to a lake, he launched like 150 feet out there and turned around and goes, so what do I do now? You're going to want to strip back in somehow.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, there's, but that's kind of what we're talking about, right? There's a divide.
I'm always speaking fishing.
Yes.
I don't give a shit. That's what I always say. I don't give a shit about yard casting.
Yeah.
I did for a little while.
My
legs.
Practicing accuracy, that's useful.
Yeah.
And trying to develop a repetitive motion.
It's just not relative to 98% of the fishing you're going to do.
Right.
Just isn't. No. Period. Don't give a shit. Unless you're steelheading and then on a single hand, but nobody does that anymore.
I did see a guy doing that on the Clearwater.
Good for him.
Yeah, I don't think he got one. That's a river where the distance is important.
Never fished it, can't tell you.
Not always. There are runs where those fish sit in close, but it's good to have a guide to get you there.
I wonder what they did 40 years ago.
Well, you had guys who could throw it far.
Yeah, 75 feet's a long ways, and you're nut deep in a river.
Yeah, well, they probably fish the runs where you can.
That was the other thing I wanted to do with the, I wanted to have a, be in the in a hole.
Yeah.
So you're just waist high into the river.
Huh? You ever tried to cast out of a kayak?
That's what I'm saying. And you're not, well, there you're sitting too, but imagine if we just dig a hole and you get nut deep in it, right? And now cast.
Now try. Yeah.
Because
I remember hearing something a while back that basically said, it was talking about spay casting and distance, right? Like anybody can do it from standing on a dock.
Yeah.
But they said essentially the general rule of thumb is you lose 10 feet for every like 6 inches you get deeper into the water.
That's what, when I, you know, as I said, when you're in the Giants pool and you're trying to keep your elbows up, you made fun of me about trying to keep my, and when you wade out and you're trying to get to that and you've got all your line here and you're trying to keep your elbows from hitting the water and you're trying to clear this line that you've got 45 feet of it around you. Yeah, you know, some guys are mouth holders. They've got it like that. Some are just coiling and holding and you're trying not, you're trying to keep your arms out of the water and you laughed. You've never been there. You just, you need to go. And you're getting pushed around by the freaking water because you need to get, you know, to that seam.
That's why I throw spin rods.
Exactly.
To avoid all of this bullshit nonsense.
Beat that horse to death.
No doubt. All right. Let's move on to a new question. Braden. How nervous did you used to get when you got called on to read out loud to the class? Sorry for the goddamn novel. Nervous. I used to get nervous reading in front of people. I didn't like that until I can talk in front of people, but reading in front of people still, reading in front of Kelly makes me nervous.
Because they stare at you?
Yeah, I don't like it. I know you're thinking mean things too. This question comes from Chris.
You were reading it than I was.
Yeah.
There's a real art to reading. They're really good politicians. They can read off a teleprompter and not.
And it doesn't look like it.
No. Yeah. It's like, they must.
That's why whenever I was giving presentations in school, it's a complete aside. No one cares about, but I would.
Especially me.
I would only do bullet points because I can't. I like struggle to just read. It's so robotic. So I'd have bullet points. I'd kind of like glance over it and then freestyle. See, told you no one was going to care about that. A few months back, I grabbed a 9-foot, 7-weight Streamer X, a sink tip line, and some articulated flies, hoping to make a fall trip westward. That got pushed. Slidein.com, by the way. Now I'm trying and failing to tempt Lake Erie steelhead with streamers. So here's my cowardly question. When I inevitably give up on streamers for the day, what's the best way to turn this into an indicator setup? Right now, I swap to an Airflow Power Taper 9-foot leader where I put my Oros tippet ring and a double nymph rig. Next time out, I'll tie some shorter leaders. In an indicator setup, how do you think weighted flies versus inline weight with unweighted flies? I feel guilty for asking for specific help, but I'm continuing to read and watch all I can get my hands on. Can't wait to see one finally take a laser legal someday. Thanks for the great podcast, Chris from Buffalo. It's kind of a two-part question. One, I think is relevant given the day we had in the boat with Howard. How do you turn a streamer setup into a nymph setup?
Hold on for a second. What rod line did he say?
Airflow Power Taper.
So we're going from he's running a floating Power Taper.
Yep.
Right? An Erie?
Yeah.
And then he wants to nymph Erie? Like drop a bait fish?
No, I think he's fishing the rivers.
I thought he said Lake Erie for coastal.
Lake Erie steelhead. My guess is that he's fishing in the river.
Oh, no, okay, no, yeah. That's fine. For some reason, I thought he was out and chasing them out in the lake, which is cool, too. How do you switch it up? That shouldn't be a problem at all. I mean,
yeah, I think he's doing it the right way. I was just trying to get you to tell the story of when you fished a bobber rig on your sinking line.
Oh, I thought he was running a floating line.
Well, yeah, he is.
Yes, I had to do that. I had to switch over. You get really short drifts, but I only had a 200. I have a 300.
No, you had a 250.
250?
Yeah.
250? Yeah, I didn't have
it. It might have been a 280. No, it was probably 250.
I don't. For some reason, I think the only rod I had that was there was a 300, because I think it was the red line. And I had a 300 grain Cortland sinking line, and it was a prototype, so I think it was the rock bottom. It's a 40-foot head.
Yeah.
And the streamer bite went to shit, and all the Hardy boys were kicking our ass by nymphing, so everybody switched but me. And so I put an indicator on a 300 grain line and changed up my leader, and I was doing I did okay with it. Almost so good for a minute that I was thinking if you took an intermediate and you could get really long drifts, because it was drifting about the speed of and you felt everything.
Yeah.
I felt it constantly. Yeah. Right? But as far as rigging up, the question was, how do you rig up? You just flat take your leader off. Just take whatever leader. You shouldn't really have to. You should be able to just go in and, you know, just add, just, I would drop shot it if it was me, but if you want to just run a fly weight fly, that's fine too. Just lengthen up your tippet a little bit and drop it down so you get sink rate, and put you don't really need to put an indicator on if you don't want to, but you can.
Yeah, you'd tight line with it. I think it sounds like this guy's running multiple spools because he's switching lines. I think that's something that
I thought he had one. I didn't hear you.
No, sorry, he was throwing a sink tip line, and then he swapped that out for a floating line.
Oh, okay.
I think the key here, like, some beginner anglers may not be aware of the multiple spools and, like, that people do this, but, like, everywhere I run in my boat bag, I have the Cortland float streamer line on a spool for my 7-weight streamer X, in case I want a mouse, frog, or we're throwing, you know, really skinny water. I want to throw small flies. Yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I always run. I carry multiple spools. I fish the lamps and stuff a lot on my streamer rides. Just because
that's a great value reel.
Yeah, they do three packs, right?
That was one of the smartest things ever.
It's genius. I mean, they got me three times.
And that's not a pitch either. I just first time ever somebody did, they had the liquid and the remix, and the spools are all cast. There's no reason to worry about casts anymore. They're great. I've never seen one break yet. But and we sold hundreds, thousands of those probably. But that is a great, you know, Doc Ellis was one of the first guys that when STH came out with their cassette setup, he's one of the first guys I ever saw do it. Mm-hmm. And man, everything's labeled. And he'd have his little box of spools, just same reel, never just pop just as quick as, no different than changing out a spool, but you still have to still take it all apart. But that was it's just easy swap. But it sounds to me like you're doing everything you should anyway.
Yeah, to me it sounds like Chris from Buffalo has got it well
dialed in.
Out.
He's just, yeah. There's no way to, you could nymph with your sink tip though.
Yeah.
You know, just.
You could tight line with it.
I mean, you're swinging. You can, yeah. It's what we did before we did right. All this stuff.
Yeah.
But it won't be as effective as bottom bouncing though.
Yeah. I'd say the only way to like actually ensure that you're going to catch a fish on a streamer is to not bring the nymph setup. Because if the nymph setup's in the back of your head and there's no streamer bite, well, like we talked about in the last podcast, you're waiting for your hour bite window or 10-minute bite window. Maybe it won't be there that day, but like if you have nymphs in the back of your head, it's really hard to figure the streamer thing out. I feel like I talk to people in the shop all the time about this. I went out and tried them and I threw them for an hour and I didn't see a single fish move on it. I didn't catch anything. So I went to nymphs and I just hammered them.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the real world.
That's a very common occurrence and it's because you got to commit to the bug.
But you'll be swinging those. They'll eat a laser. They'll eat a lot of stuff. In particular, as you get your drop backs, as they're dropping back to the lake, pay attention to those. And they'll eat a lot of bugs, man. I've had some pretty epic. I've had my best day ever steelhead fishing with two clients. Was on dropbacks. We also got hit by a tornado that day, but which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, what was that all about?
There's something weird happens in front of those tornadoes, and it sunk our boat, Dave and Dave. And we went. It was the craziest world, but. We were fishing Royal Coachmans and something else for trout, kind of, and every steelhead in that river was eating those things. We got 3 dozen fish, 2 guys, and it was in a really short window. And then we went around a corner and the boat just started sinking. And all of a sudden it popped up and the world changed. We're in the tornado. Just hunkered down in the water and waited for it to go over. Trees are going by. It was the craziest shit you ever saw. But yeah, the dropbacks can be a lot of fun.
Okay, so I've got an email here from Bradley Ramsey. It's more of a comment, but I kind of want to ask a question based on it. Just a quick note to say thanks for an awesome pattern. This email's titled Zoo Cougar and Bass in Stillwater. Thanks for an awesome pattern. I tied mine with flanks from mallards, gadwalls, and wood ducks I killed last fall, intending to fish them for trout mostly. But on a couple of side trips to what I call my R&D waters, local farm ponds in MSLAAR, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, they proved to be deadly on largemouth bass and even big bluegill. I live in Mississippi.
What's that? I read this.
You did. Okay. I live in Mississippi and don't get to fish for trout as often as I'd like, but they will definitely be staples in my warm water boxes from now on. And I'll be tossing them on future trips to Montana as well as trout streams in Arkansas. Love the podcast and videos. They sent some photos, some bass, and some pretty nice looking bluegill here. Did you see those?
Mm-hmm.
And then so my question here is, what species of fish have you personally landed on the Zoo Cougar?
All the ones you just said.
Bass, bluegill, trout.
And one thing about smallmouth, he's doing largemouth in spots, I assume.
Yeah.
But stripers, wipers.
What's a wiper?
Hybrid.
Okay.
Perch, bluegill, bass, smallmouth. In the smallmouth world, a lot of the smallest guys like to run white. I still do just as well on the yellow version and the black for the smallmouth that I fished, which was both, river smallmouth for the most part. I've caught cutthroat. I've got pretty much everything, I think. Pike, bass. I can't think of one right now. The biggest sale I ever had of that fly before the internet, I sold a bajillion of them. I can't remember now if it was 36 dozen or if it was, I think it was 36 dozen to a club in Portland, Maine. And they're in the estuaries, they fished them for stripers there. Yeah. Guy told me he's caught bluefish on them. The guy was out there when I was speaking at Beans. Pretty much anything, I think. It's just, you know, it's bait fishy looking.
Yeah.
Doesn't really do any one thing that well, but kind of does a lot of them generalities. So
whitefish?
Hmm? Whitefish?
Yeah. Have you got a whitefish on a zoo cougar?
I think so.
I caught one on a silk kitty the other day.
I heard about that.
Yeah. It had
I think we did get a whitey. I can't remember who did it. Might have been Devane.
I bet someone has at some point.
I'm sure they have. But anything that's chasey, they're going to eat it.
I mean, what do you think out of your fly patterns is the best, like, all-around, like, general species pattern? I know the dungeon, like the first fish I caught on a dungeon was a huge perch. I was fishing it over weed beds in Lake Washington looking for bass, and it just got clobbered. It's the biggest perch I've ever caught.
Hmm. I don't know. The barely legal would be up there. The peanut envy would be. The envy is just so foody looking, you know, that would be up there. The cougar's the woolly sculpin. Cougar for sure is up in there. I fish cougars. There's no place I haven't fished. It's just so general. It's so,
yeah.
It's like a woolly bugger or a muddler. It's just so, not really something, but everything kind of.
It could be something.
And the same with the peanut envy. It's not, it's so
it's just exacting
worm pattern. Looking, yeah. Maybe, leechy, maybe. Some people think when it's whiter. What's the guy that knocked it off? What's that one called?
There's the Goldie.
Goldie Hawn or whatever that was, the Goldie.
What's the...
That color phase is just really good for...
it's not the brown... Is it the brownie? No, what's the other? There's another, like, IE
fly. I don't know.
Goldie.
The Goldie.
Johnny's listening to this and punching the roof of his car.
Yeah, because he can't tell us the name of the fly. But there's... I don't know. That, you know, the dungeons are great fly in its own realm, but I don't think it's as versatile as a you can do so much with a envy or a barely legal.
Well, it's like every
in the bait fish world,
every waterway in the world has something that's olive over white in it.
Yeah, and almost all and everything has a trout except for like three in the world I think have sculpin in them, which I did fish in the Dakotas where they told me there's this is the guy who corrected me. He goes, this creek does not have sculpin in it. I says, it will someday. It goes to the Missouri. It's going to end up with sculpin.
One person told me that Silver Creek doesn't have sculpin. I can't say I've ever seen one there, but I also don't look for them that hard. But I've caught fish on dungeons in there and other sculpin-y looking stuff. Yeah. So I don't know. If you know for sure on Silver Creek, I'm very curious about that. Don't want to be spreading misinformation.
I don't know about that one. I've never seen... And it doesn't really matter if the stuff's there anyway.
Right.
Because they just... It's a reactionary thing to a degree. I mean, I don't think bass in a lot of lakes I fished had sculpin in them. Maybe bullheads. I don't know. I sure ate it. Oh, and I was saying that the smallmouth guys use white. I think I did answer that. And a lot of those guys... I never had a bad experience, but it was never better than the yellow.
Yeah, wait, what were you saying? You said a lot of people use the white envy, think it's what?
A minnow,
yeah. Yeah, or just, I don't know, it's big.
It's just a simple, that's such a versatile thing. It's just so nothing.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, it's they like it.
All right, this next question comes from Riley Hansen. Says, love the podcast, been a tremendous resource, as have your tying and fishing videos. I just placed an order with you guys, slidein.com, this morning for some Varner deer hair as well as a new line.
Just talked to Josh last night.
Did you?
Go.
As well as a new line for my spay rod. I'm so glad you started carrying spay products, slidein.com. I quite look forward to tying soulful flies with the Varner hair you have so highly recommended. I haven't... finish the episode yet. In fact, I'm just starting, so if you touch on this during the podcast, I apologize for any potential redundancy. In my opinion, many of the people who gravitate towards so-called soulless perdigons are really just in the game for the fish rather than the experience. I'm going out on a limb here, and I say I think these are also very often the same people who are not tying their own flies. As a stereotypical pretentious fly fishing snob, I hate to fish with flies that I personally did not tie. Tying the flies is all part of the experience, and simply throwing some flash and UV resin on the hook does not make for much of an experience at all. I've been asked on more than one occasion if I like fly fishing or fly tying better. My response is that there isn't really one without the other. Fishing for me begins at the vise as I'm tinkering and experimenting. Tying culminates with testing on the water and taking mental notes on adjustments and improvements to be made in different patterns. Now, don't get me wrong. I have tied and fished purrgeons in the past and will likely do so in the future. But if I had to only use purrgeons, I think I would be missing out on the quintessential fly fishing experience that is found in tying and fishing soulful flies that incorporate some more natural materials. My question is, do you think if more people tied their own flies, would less or more people throw purrgeons because they are easy to tie and effective? Furthermore, what is the longevity of an angler's fishing career if they only ever fish purrgeons? Is it likely that they will burn out and move on from the sport? I will admit that follow-up question is more tongue-in-cheek, but I wonder if there may be something there. I'd love to know your thoughts. By the way, I've been meaning to send an order your way for some time now to support the shop and as a thank you for the energy you put into producing great content and information. Thanks again.
Running out of voice. This is not good.
First time?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, first, I think you're right in a bunch of spots there. People who don't tie their flies, they're missing, but most people don't tie their own flies.
I remember looking at there's some estimates online that like 6 to 12% of anglers tie flies.
Yeah, it's not, never.
Of fly anglers.
Yeah, it's never been big. It's always been in the old days, because it was hard to learn. Didn't have mentors, you didn't have books, and you're missing a picture or whatever. It was a pain in the ass. Now you got all these resources on YouTube, and Jesus, it's no different than casting or anything else. You've got the best casters, the best tires in the world at your disposal. I mean,
hey, giving it away for free.
Yeah, it's just right there. You can see it. So it's really, I think that's bumped from the old days. It might be up to 20% now. I don't know, because it's grown rapidly. But the people that, I don't know if I would stuck with fly fishing if I didn't tie my own flies. That was just me personally. But most people I know don't. But I think it enhances everything you do in fly fishing when you design your own flies. I think it makes you fish harder and better when you fish your own flies, because you do not want them to fail. You want to learn to fish the fly. When you go out and throw a purrgeon and they catch fish, they flat out fish, and they're probably the best fishing tool in history of fly fishing. Yeah. I mean, honestly, they're so good. They get down where they belong. They stay there. Everything is good. But contrary to what you said, was it Riley?
Riley.
But what you said, Riley, was that I'm seeing a trend where they're not going away. They're going into the, as I said a couple of videos ago, podcasts ago, the people are coming around now and saying they want to try that dry fly fishing thing, which just makes me want to cringe every time they say that. And so I don't think it would be really hard. It would be really hard to go, and maybe it won't be, but imagine if your learning curve is learning to catch fish, mm-hmm. and that's your desire and you catch fish. Well, if you go out and you're even a moderately good Euro nympher, you're going to catch fish, mm-hmm. and quite a few of them. And now it's kind of like when people go out hunt and shoot a giant whitetail their first day, or like a friend of mine caught a 30-inch brown on her third cast. It's like, now what, right? So it's kind of hard, but maybe if you've learned to enjoy the whole the hunt, you know, you're going to go try that dry fly thing. And when they say, oh God, that's just disgusting. But they, I think it'll be hard for them to stick to that. I think it'll be hard to, I watch a lot of these people that are going to go into the dry fly fishing and do it and get away from it. And it's been the last two, I think we talked about this in two videos ago. The last 2 years, not this year as much as the year before, a lot of people walked in, all the same story. Yeah, I've been doing the Euro thing for 4 or 5 years. I'm pretty bored with it. I want to try that dry fly thing. And so I don't think we'll lose them completely. I just wonder, kind of like the guy who we were just talking about that in the Erie.
Oh, I don't remember his name. Chris.
Chris was saying, like Braden said about Chris, if you take your nymph rod, you probably won't throw your streamer rod because you know you're going to catch fish that way. So I don't think, I don't know if they'll leave completely. I don't know how, to me, it would be a lot harder to go out and have being able, knowing I can go catch 30 fish this afternoon, or I can go out and maybe get an eat or two. It's going to be hard to go from one to the other. It's easy to go from, you know, perfecting a much more difficult craft in the dry fly world and then jumping into the Euro. Well, you're a hero as soon as you get that Euro stick in your hand.
Yeah.
And so you're, you know, Euro to hero. And so it's a, I think it'll be, I don't know. I don't think people will stick as well. Maybe, who knows? Because it is, you know, it's not all about catching fish, but when you start, it kind of is.
Yeah.
You got to get some gratification. Yeah, you got to get, something's got to work.
So I don't know if my take's really that different on this, but, you know, I recently started tying again, what, maybe a month and a half ago. I took a couple of years off, and I never really had, and I know I said it last episode as a, I caught my first steelhead on a fly I tied. Well, I said it because some people think that's really cool. I didn't feel anything. Like, I released the fish before I even thought about it, and I went, okay, yeah, I mean, that's cool. Steelhead eat a lot of different stuff. That's cool that it was one I tied. I didn't have this warm, glowing feeling that I think some people get from it. And I'm not trying to, like, belittle you. If that makes you feel good, that's awesome.
Well, there's one difference, though. Swing flies are... You didn't design the fly. You didn't,
No.
You just copied the fly, and you tie. When I think about this, I think about learning to tie a nymph and a wet fly and a dry fly and a streamer, and you learned the craft of tying, and it felt good to go out and use your flies.
But you fished
a long time without.
Yeah.
And when I grew up, the people I knew that fished all tied. You know, there's like four of us.
Right.
So we all tied. And so, and it was also a generation where you had to learn entomology and all that stuff. And so it was really fun to, I remember like it was yesterday after Barney Ewing showing me how to tie a dubbing loop properly. And I tied a long time. And my brain opened up to a million different possibilities to make a fly do things in a nymphal form. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just mayflies. I could see where you could move the undulate, a pupating caddis body. The world just blew up for me, right? And that was so exciting, and it just added to the game.
Yeah.
Right? And so... But again, that was back when they had seasons. I keep harping on this like forever.
Old man yells at cloud.
Well, you couldn't go fish every day. So right. Your brain got encapsulated into making the flies to go fish. When you put a winter into tying, remember you had no internet, none of that shit. You had nothing that you came home from school. There's nothing on TV that you want to watch. And you tie flies, right? Or you did something, and you read about it. And I think it was different then. Although in some ways, I think now you could get on that, you know, internet and just go down a million holes and get all that information right at your, it'd be totally easier and faster and you'd learn quicker. Yeah. So it might be better yet. I don't know.
I think the ability, like, people can advance through fly tying very quickly now because of all the resource. Like, that's why I started tying flies is, I was working an office job in Seattle thinking about fishing when I couldn't be. And so to me, it was like, I'm going to do this because it's sort of involved in the fishing, right? Mm-hmm. And then I moved out here and went, man, I really like fishing a lot better than I like tying. Right. I can just buy my flies.
But you get to fish every day here.
Right.
So if by now you were done fishing, you would want to do something else. You'd cast more. You'd practice casting more. You'd tie more.
But that's what I'm now, you know, getting back into tying. And it's been great having, you know, you, Kyler, Chuck, and Jake around to, you know, critique me and help me improve and show me new techniques and all this stuff. But I still don't like have that warm, glowing feeling inside when I catch a fish on a fly I tied. It's not to say I don't enjoy tying. Like, I'm really enjoying trying to improve and like refine my skills and build these, you know, beautiful, to me, beautiful flies. It's very satisfying, but it's almost still like a separate thing than fishing for me. And I think that's maybe because I'm not trying to design something new that I'm like, I've thought about this winter trying to actually get into tying swing flies for myself that I want to do something particular. And then I might have that warm, fuzzy feeling.
I don't know if it's warm, fuzzy as much as it is. It's been a long time since I tied a fly and went, oh, that's my fly.
Right.
I mean, like 30 years. And so, but it feels good to see the fly work. But on a selfish note, Riley, I'd probably go out of business if the other 80% started tying. I don't know. The tying materials would go up, but
a lot more materials.
But the fly world, you know, selling flies in a retail store, even the tires buy them, you know. But if everybody was tying, and the way kids nowadays are so good, the new, excuse me, the tires now, it probably would equal out because there's such a huge mass of fly tires nowadays. But I would say even back when I first started, I would say 90%. You have to remember that until just recently, the average angler fished less than 10 days a year.
Yeah.
And it's not that much different nowadays for the mass.
Yeah.
But even with the seasons open and all that, so it's the pressures. You just don't have, I could watch in the old stores, watch my materials go out the door for about a month a year.
Yeah.
Right.
This time of year.
Yeah. Right. Well, right now, two times. You'd see it in the spring. Guys are getting ready to go out, and then the fall for a little while. After deer season, they'd tie for a while, but that was it.
Yeah.
It's just the, you know, kids that would do it a lot.
What do you think of people who only fish their own flies that they tie?
In the trout world, I don't think, I've said this before, and I don't want to piss anybody off because I also brought, you know, people up and mentioned their names, how great they are that don't. But from a guide perspective and from a great angler's perspective, I've never met one that's great that doesn't tie.
Yeah.
Now, I shouldn't say it. I met very few. I know a handful, because we have a new generation of anglers. You know, there's a lot of trust fund kids now that just don't, they just fish, right? That's all. They can be anywhere from 16 to 60 years old. And they've just fished around the world. That's all they do. Mm-hmm. You know, if they work, it's very little. And they become spectacular. But they're spectacular at being guided, usually. Yeah. And they're spectacular casters, and they've got everything. But when you find somebody who moves the needle a little bit, you know, from a guide perspective, or they were designing flies and they were making flies to do a purpose. That the purpose, including that freaking Pertagon.
Yeah.
Guy did that fly on purpose, right?
Right.
To do something. Yeah, and he really shifted the needle like a seismically. You know, it was crazy, right? But
do you think he feels like Oppenheimer creating the bomb?
When he looks at his royalty checks, I bet he does. I'd love to have that royalty. I just don't know any superstar great. And I'm not going to say I don't know any. Of all the greatest anglers I know, they all have been so deeply entrenched into fly tying and designing.
Yes.
Not just tying. You don't take the Jurisex and the Buckies and the Moors and the, you know, all the guys that we talk about. It just doesn't happen by picking a fly off the shelf because it says somebody's name on it. They look at it and they go, that's the best you got? Here, let me make it worth something.
Let me try.
Yeah. And that comes with situational fishing, where you get to a situation where suddenly that fly doesn't work. Mm-hmm. My Cripples and Spinner book, I came to a situation where I was not catching fish. The night it happened, I was killing it, but they changed their way they're eating. Mm-hmm. I got lucky. And before that, I would get to this one situation, I could not catch fish. And I got fish everywhere. And to bend that hook was a situational change. That, to me, was like, whoa, wow, right? Or fishing sunk spinners. People didn't really fish spinners sunk back then. Mm-hmm. Situational thing where you go, well, I need a fly that would look like this. And you go out and you say, okay, and boom, you catch a fish. Oh, you get another. Whoa, what's the next step? Oh my God, my client can catch fish with it. That situational, fixing something that was broke, Swisher and Richards, I mean, Clouser, Dahlberg, maybe the greatest thing of all time, Dahlberg diver. I mean, trying to make things that, you've fixed a problem, right? Mm-hmm. You don't get to that level by just picking up my fly and going fishing and saying, okay, it'll always, when it does, nobody's flies always work.
Right.
I don't care what fly it is, just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And you go out and the person, in particular young anglers, because their brains aren't fixed, you know, haven't been fishing for 40 years and they've only fished, you know, their fly or Gallup's fly or Craven's fly or whoever, right? Mm-hmm. And they're moldable, and they think outside. That's why I've always said I like to fish with young anglers. I like to fish with, you know, people who are questioning everything that you say. Everything, you know, doesn't matter. I mean, Jesus, being with Johnny that first 10 years, it was the worst. I mean, a guy never shut up asking, well, what if we did that? Why don't you shut up and just fish, you jack? It's like, never. Well, let's put this on this. And he didn't tie back then.
Yeah.
He did, but not well like he does now. It was just like never ending.
Yeah.
And he pushed more flies my way by him never shutting his mouth. If he'd went and tied them, they would have been his.
Right.
You know, stole everything he ever talked about. It's like, cool. But it's just, that's why. It's just that, When you tie, and I don't care, it always amazed me that there isn't more salt tires, like they didn't change as much as the trout world did, but, you know, they don't really have to as much, but I've never, like I said, never seen a superstar that, you look at the Mike Mercers of the world, mm-hmm. Mike Mercer, most understated superstar in history. I don't think he's ever fished somebody else's fly. And he's got as many, Craven, yeah. Same thing. These guys, Howard, they or they'll take your fly and make it better.
Yeah.
Andy Sabota, his line to me when I first met him, never had an original idea in my life, but I sure made a lot of your flies better. Like, you little prick. And it was true.
Yeah.
You know? So I think it's important, but I don't think it's the end of the world. Not everybody wants to get... Most people just want to go catch some fish and go home and have a beer.
Right.
I mean, they don't take it like we do. They just want to have fun. God, can you imagine if they all took it like we did? It'd be boring as shit. There'd be no parties here.
All right, let's wrap this one up. My song of the week this week is going to be Shady Grove off the Pizza Tapes. It's a great tune. Go give it a listen.
Oh, no, I lost my thing. Who was I with the other day? What was the one I wanted to remember? Oh, God. David Allen Coe.
David Allen Coe. Bang on. All right.
Boom.
See you next week.
Thank you. Hope you liked it. Hope it helps you out.